And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHO with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. In Wiley Cash's debut novel, it's called A Land More Kind Than Home, we will meet a storefront preacher who turns out to be one of the most complicated and interesting villains I've ever encountered in fiction. The new book is set up in the mountains in Madison County. It's already working its way up the bestseller list. So it's a treat to have you on Who's Talking, Wiley Cash. Thanks for coming to Chapel Hill.
And it's a treat to be here. I was outside just now thinking, man, is there a prettier place in this country than Chapel Hill in the springtime? And
I don't know
that there is.
What about along the French Broad River going past Marshall in Madison County? That's not a bad
sight. It's very pretty there, too.
This is where your novel is set. But you think like a mountain boy, but a mountain man, but you grew up in Gastonia. Mm-hmm. You're a mill boy.
Yeah, a lint head, I guess.
I guess
you could say. Yeah, I grew up in Gastonia. My dad's family is from Bowling Springs, North Carolina. My mom's family is from Gastonia. So,
Bowling Springs, that rings echoes of Ron Rash.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, he's in Bowling Springs, North Carolina, and Bowling Springs, South Carolina, I think. I don't understand...
Yeah. His family's from that area. That area is just west of Shelby, North Carolina.
In Cleveland County,
in
near
Cleveland
Garner
County.
Webb.
Mm-hmm.
Did y'all go back out there for church and homecomings and things
like
that? Yeah,
we'd go out there. My grandparents lived there, and we spent a lot of summertime days out there at the church with them or shooting basketball in the church parking lot in Shelby.
It's coincidental that you and Ron Rash have upbringing roots in the same part of the world in Boiling Springs and Cleveland County and Gaston County. And now you've set your first novel in Madison County, North Carolina, which is the same county that Rash set his most recent novel.
Absolutely.
So are y'all in touch with each other? Did you plan this?
I've met Ron a couple of times. No, we didn't plan it. That would have been something. But I've met him a couple of times at festivals, and we've emailed a couple of times back and forth. He's one of the nicest guys out there. If you want to buy a kind, generous man's novel, buy that one. He's a great guy. But
Y'all are both, I mean, I don't know what it is about the water, but the storytelling runs deep in Bowling Springs,
I guess.
I'm going to go down there and get some of that water. Well, Wally, let's come back to you later on if we get there. But tell us about this is your first novel,
mm-hmm.
and you we got to say you went to Carolina.
I went to UNC Asheville.
You went to UNC Asheville,
undergrad.
And you did your you did graduate work down in Louisiana, is that
right?
I did.
I got a PhD down in University of Louisiana in Lafayette, Louisiana, right in the middle of Cajun country.
Okay, so you went to, and you came under the influence of a Professor Gaines?
Yeah.
He's a writer that we should all know about.
Yeah, he's a moderately well-known American author, Ernest Gaines. I'm teasing, of course. He wrote A Lesson Before Dying and the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman and Gathering of Old Men.
Just a few good ones. And did you go down there particularly for him? And so at Asheville, who put you in touch with him when you were?
Well, I went to Asheville and did my undergrad work there, and I chose Asheville, UNC Asheville, because they had an undergraduate degree in creative writing. And I think like right after my ninth grade year, I knew I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to learn how to become a better writer, and I set my sights on Asheville. So thank God they took me into the program, or I don't know what I would have done. But I finished my degree at UNCA, and then I went to UNC Greensboro, and I was there for a year and a half, and I got a master's in English. And I loved living in Greensboro, but I wanted to focus more on writing. And the program at UL Lafayette is a literature-based creative writing degree. So we did all of the reading that someone with a PhD in literature does. We did all of the writing, all the the classes and the scholarly essays and stuff. But we also took creative writing workshops. And I chose that because Gaines was there. I'd read a bunch of his books. But I also chose it because I figured that was as far into the American South as I could go. And I'd spent my life in North Carolina, and I love North Carolina. I'd never really lived outside of North Carolina. But something was calling me down that way, and it was I've never regretted that move for a moment. It was wonderful. I mean, I've never lived anywhere else like that I never spent time anywhere else like that. It's the most culturally rich place I could imagine. So,
well, I'm guessing that you started writing your first novel while you were there.
I did. It was actually my PhD dissertation. It sounds very dry and academic.
And you're down there in Cajun country almost and writing about the mountains of North Carolina.
Yeah, it was funny. So I get down to Louisiana, and my first day I realize that the street signs are in French. There's dangerously potent fire ants, and they only have one season, and it's called summertime. And people, their accents were different, the food was different, the weather was different. And almost immediately, I was desperately homesick for North Carolina. And Western North Carolina in particular, because that's where I've been living.
You were homesick for Asheville rather than Gastonia.
Yeah, my parents moved out of Gastonia in 98. And a lot of my friends I grew up with have left as well, just, you know, going to school and staying and raising families in other places. And so I went to school in Asheville for, you know, 4 years and lived summers there. And then I taught at UNCA for a year and a half after that, when I got my master's. So, I feel like Western North Carolina is home probably more than any other place, you know. So when I got down to Louisiana and it's saltwater and swamps and marshland and sugarcane, I just thought, man, what have I done? There's no mountains here. There's no fresh water. There's no, you know, bluegrass music. So I realized how important those things were to me once I didn't have them.
Wow. Well, you went back in your mind to Carolina, in your mind mountains.
Absolutely.
And to Madison County, which for those people in Chapel Hill that don't think much beyond the boundaries of Orange County, Madison County is up there a little bit north of Asheville, sort of on the Tennessee line.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, we like to think of it. I was eating lunch with a former legislator today, and we like to think of it as the country where Liston Ramsey came from.
Yeah.
He was the longtime speaker of the North Carolina House who loved the mountains, and you must love them too.
Absolutely.
But tell us about your book. Tell us about the story. Tell us about the characters.
Well, the basic plot is it's a novel about the bond between two young brothers growing up in Madison County in the mid-1980s. The youngest one is 9 years old. His name is Jess, and the oldest one is 13. His name is Christopher, and his nickname is Stump, because he's never spoken a word in his life.
He's not a stump speaker.
He's not a stump speaker. Not in this political season. It's easy to make that connection. But
how do you get that nickname?
Somebody says that he is so peaceful because he sits like a stump in a cleared field. So, and also, you know, if you got a stump in a cleared field, they're hard to get out. You know, you got to wrench them out. So that's kind of describes his personality.
So these are two young boys, and the younger boy has to look out for his older brother.
Absolutely.
Because his older brother is mute.
Absolutely.
Speak.
Absolutely. And the central action in the novel is Stump is taken inside of a holiness church, a science-following church, and tragedy ensues after he is taken inside this mysterious church that has newspaper covering the windows and rumors of snake handling and faith healings and all kind of stuff. And Jess is aware of the fate that's befallen Stump, but the adults in the novel are trying to piece together this mystery of why this 13-year-old boy would be inside this church, why this kind of tragedy would befall a community that results in a child's death.
This church, which is right there on the river, just outside of Marshall,
mm-hmm.
I guess. I could never figure out which side of the river it was on, whether it was on the city side or the other side, or maybe you didn't want us to know that. I didn't. But anyway, this is a special kind of church, and it rings a bell with everybody. When you start talking about snake handling,
mm-hmm.
you think about mountains and mountain religion. And this is one of those, I would just say it would be rare in the mountains now, but they're there.
Absolutely.
of people who as a part of their religious service handle snakes. Now, where does that come from? I mean, what's the deal on that?
Well, there's a verse in the Bible. It's Mark chapter 16, verses 17 through 18 that says after the Pentecost, the people are told that you will know believers because these signs will accompany them wherever they go. They will be able to pick up snakes without being bitten. They'll be able to drink poison without being harmed. They'll speak in new tongues, and they'll lay their hands on the sick, and the sick will get well. And so these folks, these snake handlers or serpent handlers, they're literalists, and they believe that in order for the Bible to be the Word of God, somebody's got to be doing this. And if somebody's got to be doing this, it might as well be them. You know, to them, it is the truth. It's a conviction. And it's something they believe in very strongly. And the minister in this novel, Carson Chambliss, uses that that power and that exceptionalism that comes with that to some pretty evil means.
Well, let's take a quick break. We're visiting with Wiley Cash about his debut novel, A Land More Kind Than Home. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Wiley Cash. He's the author of a brand new novel, A Land More Kind Than Home. It's his first novel, and it's exploding. You got to be really happy about what's happening.
I'm really happy. I'm amazed, actually. I'm very thankful and very happy.
Well, you're not amazed. You knew it was good, didn't you? Didn't you know it was good?
I hoped it was good. I hope people would find something in this novel that resonated with them, whether it's the role of family, whether it's the role of faith in the community, whether it's maybe their own skeptical views of the power of faith. I mean, I was hoping this would be a book that would resonate with people of all stripes who like all kinds of fiction.
Well, I want to talk some more about that. And to talk about it, I think we have to talk some more about the main villain, the religious character, the pastor of this church, Carson Chambers. And tell us about him. Where did he come from?
I think he was a product of the story. This is a group of charismatic believers, and I think that when you have any kind of passion in a community, whether it's political, financial, religious, there's always somebody who's willing and ready to take advantage of that passion. And I think he sees a place for himself to gain some power and hold some sway over some people and, start creating myths about himself that he eventually believes.
Well, I'm picking up this, that he... Are you suggesting he's not a person of genuine faith? He's just an exploiter of other people's faith?
I don't know. I mean, I think he probably is a person of genuine faith, but I also think that maybe his faith in himself supersedes his faith in the unseen hand of whatever it is that he says is backing him.
Well, give us a little biographical information about Carson Chambliss.
Well, Carson Chambliss is originally, in the novel, he's originally from Georgia, from the northern mountains of Georgia. And one day he shows up in Madison County, North Carolina, with a body that's been scarred from some mysterious happenings. And people in the congregation, there's a rumor that comes around that he was burned by the things of the Lord and by the world. And once he found faith, he was able to purify himself, and nothing can burn him ever again. So he handles lamp oil and drinks poison and handles snakes and all these things. But, of course, our sheriff, who's trying to get to the bottom of the mystery of what happened inside that church, realizes that with a little bit of research that Chambliss was actually burned in a meth explosion where a young runaway from Mississippi was also
It's not
hurt.
Too unusual to have committed Christians, really, I mean, hard-nosed Christians, mm-hmm. who had an experience in early life in which they were pretty bad people.
Absolutely.
And they made a turnaround. They've been saved, and mm-hmm. they are even more committed than people who never went off on a tangent and did anything really bad.
Yeah, absolutely.
So was Carson Chambliss still a bad guy, or did he really get converted? Or are we supposed to... you don't want to tell us that.
I don't want to tell you. I think you can draw your own conclusions. But it's funny you say that. I had a professor at UNCA, a man named Milton Reddy, who I told him.
He's the greatest North Carolina
absolutely,
historian.
Absolutely, yeah. He's one of the more entertaining, interesting guys I've ever met. And one time I was visiting him in his office, and I said, Dr. Reddy, I think I'm going to go for a PhD and try to be a college professor. And he said, Wiley, I got to tell you, the worst sinners always make the best preachers. And I thought, okay, so I'll have to remember
that. What did he mean
that.
By that?
I don't know. He had me in a couple of classes, so
well,
I'll let you draw
get
your
A's
own conclusions.
Did you get A's or B's or C's?
I got a little bit of all of it. A little bit of everything thrown my way in college. But I do think that, you know, our greatest sinners often become our greatest, the greatest, most healed of us, and perhaps the best healers. But I think it also goes the other way. I think the most holy among us are also open to the most vice as well.
One of the interesting things about your book is the way you choose to voice it. That's, quote, voices. In other words, Lots of authors have to decide whether they're going to write in the third person or the first person. There are complications to doing it every way. And as a scholar of the English language, you must have wrestled with that. But you fool us all, and you have three narrators, three people narrating.
Absolutely.
Why'd you do that?
Well, I think for the book itself, I mean, this is a literary mystery. You know, the community is trying to get to the mystery at the center of the tragedy involving this young autistic boy, and everybody in the novel has his or her little piece of knowledge, and they're all putting their knowledge of the event together to put the case to the reader about what happened. And if I had relied on one narrator, the story wouldn't have been complete. If I had relied on two, it still wouldn't have. I really felt like I needed these three voices to give a clear, accurate round portrait of exactly not only what happened in this community, but also the community itself. And I think that Southern storytelling lends itself to that. I mean, we have a great history of multi-voiced novels. I mean, from all the way from Faulkner to Ernest Gaines to, you know, there are tons of Flannery O'Connor does that sometimes. I mean, we have all these traditions, and even in our families, you know, everybody has their own story of the same event. You know, we sit around and tell them over and over, and it's told differently every time.
Well, I loved it. Did you start out to write in three voices, or did you?
I didn't. My first narration was from the perspective of the father, Ben, who's the father of the two boys. And I realized pretty quickly, I don't have children of my own, that I couldn't speak
in
his voice.
Daddy's shoes.
I couldn't put myself there. And I think it goes back to what the sheriff says at one point in the novel, that you don't understand what it is to lose a child unless you've lost one.
Yeah.
Because it takes
a
lifetime to build an equity in loss.
You're getting me diverted from where. I mean, that's such a powerful concept. But one of the people you choose to be the narrator is an older woman. She's deeply religious, but she reacts negatively to the to Pastor Chambliss and his bringing snakes and poisons into the service. And there's one awful scene that I'd love for you to preview for us, in which she has to make a decision about whether she's about what kind of relationship she's going to have with this church.
Absolutely.
And if you can just say, well, I want to tell you that.
Well, the opening scene in the book is a memory that Adelaide Lyle has about the moment she decided to take the children out of the church and keep them to herself during the service.
These are the children. She doesn't have children of her own, I guess, but she's sort of the mama to everybody.
Yeah, she's kind of the cultural conscience of the community in many ways.
And so the children gravitate to her. And in this church, to question whether the children should be in the service at all because of the snakes and
absolutely.
The poisons and all that.
Absolutely.
She keeps the children.
Absolutely. It happens after an elderly woman is bit by a snake during a service. And the church covers it up, and they take her body and put it out in her tomato garden as if she was, you know, gardening.
Bitten by a snake out there.
Bitten by a snake out there, and they leave her body out there. And Adelaide looks around and says, this is no place for kids. This is no place for my worshiping or my truth as I know it. And I'm taking the kids. And she stands Chambliss down, and he lets it happen.
She stands him down in the circumstances that scared me to death.
Yeah.
I mean, some of us, we have different degrees of being frightened about snakes.
Yeah.
And I'm not really generally frightened about snakes. But if you make me hold one, or a poisonous snake, or if you put my hand down in the box where they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And he uses them as a means of intimidation, you know, and it definitely intimidates her, the scene. There's a scene where he shoves her hand into a snake box, and she can hear the rattle coming from inside the box. And he dares her basically to tell the truth about what she knows.
Nevertheless, she doesn't stay in the church, but she stays associated with the
absolutely.
Church by keeping the
it's
kids.
It's her church. That's the way she sees it. It's her church. It's her duty to protect these kids, many of whom she brought into the world. So I think she feels the burden that a lot of women in communities feel to pick up where the parents left off sometimes.
Well, tell us about your third narrator, or tell us about the other two narrators.
Well, the second narrator is 9-year-old Jess. He's the younger brother of the autistic boy. And he is a very curious kid, but he's also very intuitive and he's very thoughtful. And he perceives things about the adult world that the adults probably aren't aware of him knowing. He knows what happened to Stump inside that church. He knows what Stump knows or what Stump saw to get him inside
that
church.
He knows what happened to Stump in the church, mm-hmm. in the sense that, what happened to Stump in the church?
Well, Stump is the victim of a healing service. They lay hands on him and try to heal him. And when he fights with him, the adults of the congregation pin his body down and end up crushing his lungs, crushing his
ribcage. And this is the mystery sort of to be solved in
Absolutely.
The novel. I mean, we know what's happening,
mm-hmm.
but we don't know whether or not and to what extent the people who are responsible are going to be held responsible.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this takes us to the sheriff.
The sheriff, yes. Clem Bearfield, he's an outsider from Madison County. He's only lived there for 25 years, so he's the new guy in the neighborhood.
Sounds like Chapel Hill.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. But he's the local sheriff, and he's edging toward retirement, and he's never had a case like this before. And he shows up after this tragedy befalls the church, and he finds a group of congregants who are silent. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to answer questions. Nobody wants to run afoul of the preacher. And he's charged with making sense of this tragedy and this mystery.
If the sheriff were able to find that as a result of a religious observance and done in good faith to try to heal someone, but it didn't work right, and in mm-hmm. fact resulted in the death of a young member of the congregation, what would be the crime?
I would imagine you could get him on all kinds of things. First of all, the original instance where the woman was bitten by a snake bite, it's illegal to handle snakes in a religious service in North Carolina. I believe the only state that hasn't made it illegal is West Virginia, where I live now. So I don't know what my indirect connection is to snake handling. But I would imagine manslaughter, to direct that kind of thing to a helpless child, might not have been his goal. Or they might not be able to prove that was his goal, but his careless action resulted in a death.
It's a careless action. Mm-hmm. As we deal with a political contribution crimes that apparently hinge not on the action but on the intent.
Absolutely.
This would have been a factor. Mm-hmm. This could have been a factor. Well, listen, we didn't come to talk about the law, so let's take a break and get geared back and talk about your book.
Okay.
Wiley Cash, we're talking about his wonderful first novel, A Land More Kind Than Home. He and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Wiley Cash. He's here in Chapel Hill on at the beginning of his first book tour with respect to his first novel, A Land More Kind Than Home. Wiley Cash, again, welcome to Chapel Hill, and thanks for sharing the excitement of all of this. You know, writers, well, we're celebrating sort of the publication of Reynolds Price's last book, sort of mm-hmm. incomplete, but he taught writing, and he found that he made a decision. He was at Oxford. He could have gotten his degree, mm-hmm. his doctoral degree. He just passed it by when he found out he could teach at Duke without it.
Yeah.
But you went ahead, even before you got your first novel published, and said, I'm going to get that credential. So, mm-hmm. Why did you do that?
Well, I think that I always knew I wanted to write, but I always knew that if I wanted to write, I had to learn how to read. And I had to learn how to read well and actively and to learn from what I was reading. And getting a PhD in American literature primarily was really a very nurturing experience for me. It taught me how to read a text. And then studying under Ernest Gaines, which I wouldn't have had the opportunity to do had I not pursued that graduate degree, really taught me how to write after I was reading. You know, it really taught me how to have a literary model and then adapt it to my own means, So I think that was really the benefit for me. And I enjoy teaching. You know, I enjoy going into a classroom and talking about American literature from, you know, the Puritans through the, you know, the Transcendentalist all the way up to, you know, the modernist or the postmodernist. I really enjoy that. And I enjoy teaching writing, too. So I thought it's a pretty good gig, you know.
Well, along those lines, who are the writers? Yeah, I mean, some writers are fanatics about what you just said. That is, how could you think to be a writer unless you've read great writing and understand some of the reasons that you, that great writing appeals to you, and steal some of the tricks?
Absolutely.
You know, but who are some of the writers who really have had an influence on you?
In terms of direct influence on my style of writing, I think my most direct influence is Ernest Gaines, even before I went down to Louisiana. You know, his minimal prose, his scaled-back dialogue, certainly him. I mean, if you're a Southern writer or trying to be a Southern writer and you're not influenced by William Faulkner, you're either, you know, you don't have a pulse,
well, it's
or
just
you're,
the opposite
you've
from
never
what
read
you
him.
Talked about, you got from Gaines.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Two-page sentences.
Yeah, and, absolutely,
and
absolutely.
So how do you blend the influence of those two divergent?
Well, what I love about Faulkner is I love his long sentence. I love the long line. I love when you turn a page and there's no paragraph breaks and you just dive in. And I love that his characters can be in dialogue. And a character can be having these incredibly complex thoughts full of these beautiful sentences and these multiple syllabic words, but then the dialogue will be yes, no, see you tomorrow. I just love that. And I think that Faulkner gives us insight to the complex emotions that humans have, but he also gives us insight into the ways in which those emotions are scaled down into terse, short sentences or looks or even silences. And I really learned that a lot from reading William Faulkner, a novel like A Light in August, you know, where we have all these different constant shifting perspectives. First-person narration, flashbacks, memories, third-person omniscient. We have all these different types of narrative things going on, and I really learned a lot from that. So Gaines, obviously, Ernest Gaines says that William Faulkner is his old man, and I joke with him. I said, "Well, that means that you're mine."
so you're a granddaddy.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So Ernest Gaines, and then writers like Clyde Edgerton, you know, who's just,
well, we love Clyde Edgerton because
North
does he bring
writer.
To you? What does he bring to you?
Well, what Clyde does for me is it gives me a sense of place. You know, Clyde knows where he's from. He knows the people he's writing about. And he writes with a sense of responsibility. You know, he says, I'm going to get this right. You know, in the Night Train, I'm going to talk about race relations. And it's not going to be clean. It's not going to be pretty. Here it is, you know. And the Bible Salesman, I'm going to talk about religion in the Deep South. Here you go. Good luck. Hope you like it. You know, I mean, he has a real responsibility of getting Eastern North Carolina right. And I just admire that. I think that's wonderful. I love Kay Gibbons, especially Ellen Foster, which I think is, you know, the our more contemporary version of Holden Caulfield. I think that Ellen's just wonderful.
Oh, well, well.
So, I mean, North Carolina writers...
Well, what about Holden Caulfield? I mean, you're not influenced by that book.
Not as much. I mean, I read it, and, you know, there might have been a time in my life where I might have looked to...
Maybe as a 16-year-old, you
at Holden Caulfield and thought, somebody finally understands me. But, that was probably when I read it, probably in college or sometime like that. But I think with Ellen, I think Ellen Foster is smarter than Holden Caulfield. I think she's more independent. I think she's tougher. I think she's more interesting. I think she's more honest with the reader. So.
Well, did any of the characters in these authors' books that you love so much, did any of the characters creep their any are their cousins creep their way into your new book?
Absolutely. If you've read Fred Chappell's beautiful novel, I believe it's from 1987, called I Am One of You Forever, about the Kirkman family living up in Candler, North Carolina. The young boy in that, the young narrator's name is Jess. And so, as a nod to Fred, who was kind enough to give me a blurb, and I did this way before I got the blurb from him, I named my character Jess.
So this is named after Fred Chappell's character?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't think I've ever told anybody that before, but yeah.
We knew we could squeeze it out. If we put those snakes in front of you, we could make you talk.
But it absolutely is. I love Fred Chappell's work. Thomas Wolfe's another writer. You know, it's not reflected in my style, but I love Thomas Wolfe. I love Eliza Gant. I love Eugene Gant. I love W.O. Gant. I love this family. You know, I think they're so...
Well, and I'm interested in this. Eliza Gant, particularly, is a tough mountain
Absolutely.
Woman. And maybe you didn't mean for him to be there, but I can see the echoes of that characteristic in the character of the mountain people that you put in
Absolutely.
Your Madison County book.
Absolutely. And if you read the long story or the short novella, I'm not sure what you call it, but The Web of Earth with Eliza narrating this circular narration of she's telling about the year that the locust came, and she says, oh, what's that noise off in the distance? And that's the horns on the ships in the bay. And I really borrowed a lot from Eliza Gant's characters when I was creating Adelaide, that voice, that circular narrative where nothing is linear, no story is completely linear. You know, Adelaide starts telling a story and then she says, well, this reminds me of the time that I was 14 years old and I left Madison County for the first time. And I'll get back to that death of that boy in a second. And this reminds me of this Confederate soldiers that came through one time. And, you know, that's how we think and that's how we tell stories. And that's how Adelaide does it. And she got that from Eliza Gant.
Well, before we take the break, real quickly, getting back to Madison County and the coincidence that your novel and Ron Rash's novel, mm-hmm. in different times, of course, but all in this small, lightly populated mountain county, it is significant when you talk about the Confederates, where this was the scene of one of the most unpleasant massacres, mm-hmm. really, you know, a real violation of human rights that took place up there. You talked about Confederate soldiers, but you didn't retell that story in mm-hmm. your novel. And I wonder, do you find, is the ghost of Sheldon Laurel in your book somewhere?
Well, there's the scene where the Confederates come in town and shoot up the town. They're hallucinating after getting a hold of some Jimson weed, and that was reminiscent of the legends or the rumors of what sparked the Sheldon Laurel massacre, where these guys went into town and killed a bunch of people, and there's conflicting reports as to the veracity of that. But as a result of that, you know, some I believe it was a Confederate home guard came in and just plucked the, I think it was 13 or 14 people out of their beds and took them out to Sheldon Laurel and just killed them. I think one of them was a 9-year-old boy or 13-year-old boy. And that story haunts Ron's The World Made Straight, his novel, which is a more contemporary novel set in Madison County. But my story that Adelaide remembers was kind of a nod to that and just a nod to say, hey, I'm aware of that. I'm not going to talk directly about it.
But I should have known that was what you were doing instead of saying
that. It's not that obvious, but I wanted to, and also gave me a chance to talk about the role of the Civil War in Western North Carolina, where that wasn't Western North Carolina's war. They didn't have a stake in that war, you know.
Well, so. We were going to have a whole semester-long course on the North Carolina mountains and the Civil War in fiction.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And all the way from, Coal Mountain on. To, mm-hmm. And now that we know that you've dipped in that well, we can include a land more kind than home.
Absolutely.
The aftermath of the Civil War in Madison County. We're visiting with Wally Cash about his new book, and he and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Wally Cash. He's here to promote his new book, A Land More Kind Than Home. And it's this extraordinary book. I mean, it's I shouldn't describe it with words, and we ought to let you tell us more about the book. One of the characters, I don't think you really intended to be so sympathetic, but I loved Jess's mama.
Yeah.
And she's really a strange woman and deeply religious. And she's under the, if people who joined us late, we're part of this novel is set in a church, which is all papered up so nobody can see in because they're dealing with snakes, but they've got a group of very loyal parishioners, one of whom is Jess's mama, and she's deeply attached to the church, to God, and to the pastor.
Absolutely.
Where did she come from?
I think that Julie, I mean, she represents a lot of us who fall sway to charismatic people. And people have asked me if I set out to create a novel with an evil religious leader, and I say no. This guy could have been a banker. This guy could have been a politician.
But he was evil.
Exactly. I mean, he could have done all of these things. And we see men and women seduced by this kind of charismatic power in all realms of society today, in all realms of culture. I'm a child of the 80s, and I grew up in Gastonia, and right next door we have PTL and Jimmy Tammy Faye Baker. You know?
So when I'm trying to visualize the minister and the snake handling minister, if I get into my Jim Baker.
I don't know if he's Jim Baker. He's a little tougher than Jim Baker.
He's mesmerized by Jim Baker.
Yeah,
I mean, I would sit and watch him on TV.
He was great. I'm ready to send in money
to buy a condo.
Get healed. Give us some money. Yeah. All these guys are. I mean, even someone as innocuous seeming as Joel Osteen. I mean, they're hypnotic to watch on television. Jimmy Swaggart, Jerry Falwell, all these guys.
Well,
are
that leads me
powerful.
To something I wanted to visit with you about. It's really not fair, but we've just gotten through with this big electoral battle in North Carolina on Amendment 1. Mm-hmm. And church people came down on different sides of this. I mean, and there were charismatic leaders on both sides. I mean, Billy Graham's on the side of, you know, this is God's plan, go along with it. Then around here, some of the most inspirational religious leaders were telling us that Jesus simply would not have us do this to mm-hmm. a group of people. But God's voice was being interpreted by different people. And so as I read your book in the context of this battle, I thought, what is Wiley Cash trying to say about the influence of religion? Is just ignore it? Just don't pay any attention to it? Or it's like everything else that's human, it's subject to... Here, I'm preaching. What were you trying to say?
I'm enjoying the sermon. I think that what my novel, I tell my students when I teach, I say, I want to leave this classroom at the end of the semester without you knowing what my politics are. And I would like for people to read my book at the end of it and say, I wonder what that guy's religious views are.
Without knowing where you go to church,
Knowing where I go to church or whether I do or not. And I think the message of this book, the thing that I wanted people to really think about, is that the same thing that destroys us is also the thing that can heal us in many ways. The same faith that tears us apart and makes us turn against each other at the ballot box can be the same thing that brings us together. And it's justice, and it's fairness, and it's equality, and it's decency, you know. And that's the basis of the Christian faith, you know. And that's what people need to pay a little bit more attention to.
Well, it's hard to get our arms around it because this church, the central church here, is an offbeat church. And mm-hmm. with snake handling, which is not really embraced by the community as being mm-hmm. A best representation of Christianity.
Yeah.
And you're, as you said, you now live in West Virginia, where there might be even a little bit more of that going on than there is in North Carolina, certainly.
Yeah.
But did you mean to say that it is that we shouldn't dismiss people who are involved in this kind of offbeat religion so quickly, or
yeah.
did you say?
Yeah, I think I'd hate to dismiss somebody just because their worship or their, you know, mode of belief seems strange to us. You know, I'm thinking back to the things we've gone through over the past 10 years after 9/11 and how quick people were to dismiss people and turn them into the other. And I think when you do that, you really miss the chance to understand people and therefore understand more about yourself. You know, I think that I don't want to get too out there, but I think, you know, devout Muslim and a devout Christian have a lot more in common than they think they do. And they probably make a lot of the same conclusions.
You've thought about this and you've watched it from Gastonia, from Madison County, mm-hmm. From Lafayette, mm-hmm. Baton Rouge, from Cajun country in Louisiana, and now from West Virginia. And so a lot of us have the impression that the hold that religion has on us as a community is ebbing, that it's mm-hmm. leaving us.
Yeah.
It's certainly not in this church in Madison County. What is your impression just generally about what's happening?
I think that faith, and I think it's the result of too big to fail. I think that America is going small. I think we're going back to small towns. I think we're going back to local businesses, and I think we're going back to personal faith. I don't think that we're drawn as a culture to the megachurch and the homogenization of belief and wholesale religion. I don't think we're going that way. I think religion is becoming, in many ways, something we nurture in private. And for centuries in America, that's what it was. You know, this idea of religion being something that's on television and politics being preached from the pulpit, that's relatively new. You know, we think because something's been a certain way for the past 20 years, that's the way it's always been, and it hadn't always been that way. And so I think we're going back.
You know? Well, Wally Cash, thanks for a great book.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing pieces of it with us. It just makes me want to go back and read it again. And come back to visit us in Chapel Hill sometime.
I will.
Soon,
thank you for having me.
Hopefully with another great book. Our guest has been Wally Cash. He's the author of A Land More Kind Than Home. Thanks to him. And thanks to you for listening. I'll be back here with Who's Talking before you know it.